Hi, I'm Dave Kramer. Shall I go like this so you can see me? I am the director of the library here at JTS, and we sponsor book talks. So when I found out from Allie as we were walking down to the subway one afternoon after work that she was publishing this book, I said, oh, we've got to have a book talk, because that's one of the things that we do in the library. And I'm extremely pleased that we plan to do this, including your inclusion, Shira, in, you know, kind of a different format than we normally do. Let me introduce this. I got Allie through the coercion of having, you know, sponsored this, the library sponsorship, to give me a copy of this early so I could undertake to read it. And then I left my copy of it at a bar in Brooklyn.
You didn't tell me that part.
Was at a bar. I had a little bit too much time before I was teaching a class at Kane Street Synagogue. So I went, you know, to get a glass of wine, and I'm reading it, and I thought I put it in my bag, and I wound up losing it. So I had to get another copy to finish it. I mean, why are we, the JTS Library, sponsoring a book talk like this, aside from the fact that Allie is a good friend of ours and supports us with all kinds of, and the whole department, you know, with all kinds of things that we do here at JTS? The answer, it occurred to me, actually, and I'm going to connect it to Passover, because I think it actually does connect in a very important way to Passover. Passover at its best, and I do mean literally at its best, is a massive act of fictionalization. And what I mean by that is not that the story of the Exodus is a fiction, it may or may not be, depending upon which scholar you ask, but that what Passover asks us to do, actually, is to imagine ourselves in the position of others in order to make ourselves better. So one of the key lines of the Haggadah is "V'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu ke'ilu hu yatzam mi'Mitzrayim." In every generation, a person, I'm now making it an egalitarian statement from its original sexist formulation, in every generation, a person is required to see her or himself as though, you know, he or she came out of Egypt, which, yeah, I mean, if we feel that, if we can actually feel it, it means that we will have greater, not only greater understanding, but greater empathy and commitment to those who find themselves in positions of oppression, which, of course, is the story of the Passover, whether real or fictional. And I've got to say that, I mean, it won't surprise you or anybody else here to learn that I've never been a pre-adolescent or adolescent girl. Nevertheless, I found myself actually able to imagine myself in that position, you know, in a very complete sort of way. And not only, you know, not any adolescent girl, pre-adolescent, adolescent girl, but a girl going through the kinds of things that you described. And it's that capability which we aspire to here as an educational institution, in everything that we do, not just in the School of Education, where, you know, part of the task, of important part of the task of education is to help people, you know, put themselves in the position of another, but to be a good rabbi, to be any kind of teacher in any community, Jewish community and any community, requires that capacity for empathy. And I think that it's, you know, stories like this that make that possible. I'm going to share with you, with everybody, a little teaching that I acquired outside of the Hemingway compound home, which is outside of Havana, in his latter good number of years, actually, as I recall. Ernest Hemingway lived and wrote outside of Havana, and so they've got these little tchotchke things for sale, you know, outside, and you can buy them for any number of, you know, Cuban pieces of money. And it says is this, and I think it's just so true: all good books have one thing in common. They are truer than if they had really happened. Right? So You know, I mean, there are parts of all fiction that have happened and other parts that haven't happened, and I don't know if you're going to comment on that, you know, or to what degree you're going to comment on it. But whatever is fictionalized doesn't make a difference because, you know, to enable someone to enter that makes it truer than if the details had really happened. So I'm glad you could do this, and thank you both for your willingness to do this wonderful program.
Thank you.
And please turn off phones.
So what we're going to do, thanks everyone for coming as well, have Ally start by talking a little bit about the book and reading a little bit from the book, and then she and I are going to engage in a little conversation, some questions that I have, talking about some of the themes of the book, and then open it up for your questions. So I hand it over to Ally.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it, and thank you for having me. So this book is sort of a dream come true for me. I wore a back brace for 2 years and 4 months from the middle of sixth grade until right before freshman year in high school. And it was a very difficult experience for me. My mom actually underwent one of the first spinal fusions in the country in November 2nd of 1969. I just learned the date like last week. I didn't know, and somebody was asking me. And it's amazing how it was so important to her. I think it changed her life. She was in a body cast for 6 months, on bed rest, and she couldn't move. And I think it sort of changed the trajectory. Hi, Sarah. It changed the trajectory of probably our entire family because it impacted my grandparents so much. They were a very lower middle class family. It had a big impact on sort of how the whole family dealt because they didn't have the resources. They couldn't leave her home alone. She was in a body cast, and how that impacted her siblings. And then when I was diagnosed with scoliosis, it sort of reopened this wound in our family that had been, you know, as soon as the experience for her, she was in the body cast for 6 months, then she wore a brace for 2.5 years, and as soon as her brace came off, it was sort of like a closed book, and nobody dealt with it or talked about it again. Her siblings didn't talk about it, her parents didn't talk about it, my boobie didn't talk about it, she certainly didn't talk about it. They just sort of moved on. And so my brace and my scoliosis reopened this huge wound for generations of people who came before me. And of course, you know, as an 11-year-old, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know sort of what was happening. But I knew that I was really mad because this brace was ruining my life. And nobody seemed to want to acknowledge that it was ruining my life. I'm a writer, and I went to the MFA program at the New School, and I had a teacher who said to me, you know, I always write from the worst thing that ever happened to me. I was trying to write a book, and I didn't know where to start, and she said, so I'd start with writing the worst thing that ever happened to you. And I said, well, when I was in sixth grade, I got a brother and a back brace in 2 weeks, and that was really bad. And she said, well, maybe you should write about that. So after graduate school, I started writing braced. And about 2 years, about 2 years later, I finished the book and I got an agent, and then we sent the book around to different editors, and the editor that ended up buying this book actually wore a brace for 6 years. And she had a very different experience. Well, I thought the brace was the worst thing in the world. It was ruining my life. It was ruining my clothes. It was ruining my relationships with boys, or so I thought, and my friends. My editor loved wearing her brace. In fact, she really misses it. And she talks a lot about how it felt like a plastic hug for her. And she misses sort of having this protective shield. And I think by our relationship and through our dialogue, I really started to think about how everybody who wears a brace comes to it with a different approach and has different experiences. She had a lot of support from her parents, whereas I didn't, because my parents were sort of trying to deal with it on their own. Oh, and I should mention my dad is an orthopedic surgeon. So I went to like the best doctor in the country who invented the Boston back brace, and there were like 25 men in the room being like, we think we should do this and we think we should do that. And so that my experience was very specific to me, and I didn't just want to reflect my own experience. I wanted this character to really go on a journey from start to finish, and to really come to some self-acceptance. So I'm going to read a little bit from the book, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit about me and what I bring to the book and my perspective. We're obviously going to talk more, but I'll read a little bit, and then we'll talk, and then you can ask some questions. Oh, and what you need to know in the scene is that Rachel, the main character, is a superstar soccer player who has just found out that she needs a back brace for scoliosis. And the only people that know she has scoliosis and know she has a back brace are her best friend Hazel and her best friend Franny and her parents. And this is right before she starts seventh grade. And that's really all you need to know. Surprise, I'm here. Hazel's voice makes me jump off the bed a little. She's standing in the doorway. Hi, I say. Wait, what are you doing here? My mom is coming over to drop off a bunch of baby stuff. You're not mad that I came over, are you? Shut up, I say. Okay, good. She smiles like she's relieved. We're leaving for Long Island in T-minus 2 hours. I won't be back until Monday, and we start school on Tuesday. I can't believe it's so soon. Her voice gets way high, like she's excited about seventh grade and soccer and Kyle and all the same things I'd be squealing about if I wasn't scared about starting school in the brace. We need to talk about first day outfits. How have we waited this long? I know, I say. I'm freaking out. My new clothes are all for fall. Same with me, she says. It's like, hello, why can't the weather know that school is starting and respond accordingly? She claps her hands together like she's trying to get excited. Okay, show me the options. I don't even know what I got. I grab onto the bedpost and pull myself up in one motion. I'm better at maneuvering around without getting jabbed by the brace. As soon as I'm standing in front of the pile of bags and torn tissue paper, I realize there's a reason everything is still on the ground. I don't think I can reach down and pick up the clothes. I bend forward and try to ignore the brace digging into the top of my thighs, as well as the feeling that I'm about to topple over. Let me do it, Hazel says. She picks everything up off the ground. What's going to happen when you get out of bounds in a game, she asks. You have to be able to pick up the ball really fast and throw it back in. I'll figure it out, I say. I've been so focused on running and kicking that I completely forgot bending down would be an issue too. I know you will. She holds up a purple skirt. This is cute, she says. It's one of the things I didn't try on, so in my head I can pretend it looks really good. I pick it up by the elastic waistband and put it next to a black tank top and a very thin gray sweater that looks like the kind of thing I might be able to hide under. With this, I ask? She tilts her head and her eyebrows scrunch together. Yeah, I think that's a winner. Not trying too hard, I ask? She shrugs, and I guess I know she's right. I can't have everything. I change into the outfit, and as soon as I'm done, Hazel says, I love it. Yeah, I don't look weird in the middle, I ask, because after what happened with that mom in the fitting room, I'm nervous about how I look in clothes. No way, she says, two thumbs up. I open my closet door and look in the mirror. She's right. I look good. The skirt is a little too short since I put the elastic part above my fake hips, but no one can see that because of the sweater, which I grabbed on our way out of the store. It's amazing. Long and a little tighter at the bottom, so the middle puffs out enough to almost cover up my hips and straps. And it's really thin, so I can probably pull it off without anyone saying anything. Anyone saying, aren't you hot in that thing? We piece together a few more outfits before Hazel's mom knocks and says that they're leaving in 5 minutes. I look at the clock. 118 minutes are up. It turns out wearing the brace is a lot less painful when you aren't counting and you're with your best friend. Can you help me out of it? I ask Hazel. Have you tried getting out by yourself? I can't. I take off my sweatshirt, reach around, and grab for the strap. See? Try pulling from the middle of the strap instead of reaching for the end. I dig my nails into the Velcro and pull from the middle like Hazel said. I tug at it until the whole strap comes undone. It works. I can't believe it. I do the same thing with the other two straps and take off the brace without any help. I drop it on the ground and hug her. Thank you, I say. I would never have thought of that on my own. No big deal, she says. Only it is.
Thank you. So, I mean, any part you would have chosen to read, I think, would lend to a really strong conversation. But the first thing I wanted to ask you about was about the one of the central themes of the book, which is friendship and engaging in friendship. And to me, it was really striking. I've read a lot of young adult novels. And I think this one really stands out for many reasons. And one is that there is romance in it, but it's not the central theme of the book. It's not the main storyline. So I would love to talk a little bit about what led you to tell her story through friendship and sports. Sports and friendship, which you don't find very much in books with a female protagonist.
So I felt like there needed to be a little bit of romance because it's fun. Mm-hmm. But that this is really a story about self-acceptance and that the truth is that romance is great, but if you don't really love yourself, then you're never going to be able to be in a even a middle school relationship that is sort of healthy, and you're going to be relying on somebody else for validation. And I felt like we needed to see a character who was trying to find validation within herself, because this is something that I think the brace makes her feel really isolated. And I think we see that throughout the book, that the brace is sort of, it's a lonely place to be. And I think we all have sort of things about our experiences that are like our own personal brace, whatever that looks like. It could be something you can't see, like a learning disability, or it could be something that you can see, like braces or glasses, or something that sort of gets in your way and makes you feel like you're the only one who's going through whatever the thing is that you're going through. And I felt like that there was nobody else that could solve that for her. So it needed to be through her own self-acceptance and her own acceptance of the brace that she sort of comes to terms with it and finds the ability to like ask for the things she needs from the people around her, even from the boy that she likes, and especially from her friends and especially from her family. So that's why I didn't want the focus to be on the boy, and I wanted the focus to be on her and building the relationships that I felt like were gonna realistically be there with her.
It's so interesting because, I mean, I looked at the friendship, when you read the book, she has very strong friendships. And I had strong friendships in high school, but I was trying to put myself in that position, and I couldn't imagine my friends being they were really supportive friends, so I was wondering where did that come from, you know, your own experience, or did you have to reach far in order to cultivate that?
I think I had really supportive friends, but even in the most supportive form, they tripped up a lot. And I tried to make it so that these friends tripped up, mm-hmm. and that they made mistakes, because we all make mistakes as friends. Even in adult friendships, we mess up and we have to sort of be told and communicated with that we hurt somebody's feelings or we didn't do something that the other person would have liked them like us to do. So, I mean, I definitely pulled from some friendships that I've had that I felt like people were real. There were moments where I felt really like people were there for me. But not from a specific person. And then I pulled from moments where I felt sort of abandoned, and where I had to stand up for myself.
And so that was another thing that really struck me in terms of her learning curve. Seemed to me that it was about finding ways to be able to express her feelings, her emotions, to stand up for herself, which is a hard thing for anyone. But if I think back to that age, it's really, really hard. So why was this important to you in the book for that to be her learning curve?
I think that one of the hardest things for me in wearing my brace was realizing that nobody else. So I went to camp with this girl. We were in two different bunks. She had a brace and I had a brace at the exact same time, and we had no idea. And it wasn't until we were older that we realized that we were wearing a brace at the same time, going through the same experience, thinking that every single person knew we were wearing a brace, and actually like nobody knew we were wearing a brace because we couldn't even find each other. And I think part of writing this book for me was realizing that there were a lot of people that didn't realize what I was going through, and it was such a big part of my life, a big part of my every single day, that I needed to learn how to advocate for myself. And I think we all need to advocate for ourselves because nobody else is thinking about our needs as much as we are. So that's true of everything. That's true of instructional swim at camp. That's true of telling your mom that you need something that you didn't, that there's no way she could know that you need that. Or at least trying to ask, because if you don't ask, then especially when you're in seventh grade, your parents aren't thinking about your needs all the time. They can't guess. And I think even now, like as an adult, having an adult relationship with my parents, I often have to ask them for things because they don't know what I need all the time, even though they're great parents and they're trying. But sometimes I have to like give them the answer. And with my husband, sometimes I have to give him the answer. And I think in life, part of life and part of growing up is learning how to give people the answer so that they can help you and that you can help yourself. And this is like the very beginning of her journey to do that. I think part of having a brace that's so special is that I learned how to do that when I was 12. And like for a lot of people, it takes a long time to sort of hit that stumbling block whatever that is. And even though it felt like, oh, why is there something wrong with me? And why do I have to go through this now? Well, it felt like no one else was going through it. I realized now that was such an advantage because you hit stumbling blocks along the way at every age. So you have to be able to get back up. And if you learn how to, the earlier you learn how to do it, the better off you are.
It seemed to me that the soccer really spit, I mean, it made it immediate, right? Because we all go through this when we have something difficult and we have that period at the beginning where it's that honeymoon period of like, oh, you know, it's gonna be fine, I'm gonna push on through. But there was a lot to push through.
Yeah.
So, and it sticks out for me that scene where she's in the bathroom and trying to take her brace, I think she was trying to take her brace off so she could go play soccer and no one thought to stay behind and help her. And she's there and like twisted into a pretzel trying to figure out how to do it. So just going back to the soccer piece for a minute, what in that felt important to you about telling this through soccer?
So when I wrote the book, I wrote it without soccer. When I handed it to my editor, there was no soccer in the book. And she was like, this is a great book. Where's the plot? Why is there no plot in this book? I love the feelings. I love all the characters. This is great. She bought it. But she was like, we need some plot. We need something to happen. We need there to be stakes.
And it really raised the stakes because she had to be able to play without falling over.
Yeah, so basically she's in the brace for 23 hours a day, which means, and soccer practice is an hour and a half. So her options are don't play soccer without the brace on for an hour and then miss half an hour of practice or figure out how to play soccer in the brace. And she decides to figure out how to play. She feels like there's no other option. Playing for only an hour is like being not on the team. So she decides that she's going to learn how to play soccer in the brace, which I actually did play soccer in my brace. I was not a competitive soccer player. It was my passion. In fact, my passion was ballet, and I did have to give that up in part because I danced for the Boston Ballet, and the rehearsals and for the Nutcracker, the rehearsals and the shows were too much time out of the brace, and it just wasn't possible to do both, so I sort of cut down to just 1 hour of ballet a week, and that also was sort of disappointing, and then I just sort of gave up on it because it was just too much. It was, like, heartbreaking. But so I picked soccer because it was something that I actually could do in my brace. And I felt like there were, one of my editors said, you need a plot, you need an activity, you need something she's passionate about. I was like, well, I need to find something that she can actually do. So I did a lot of research and called like the Boston Back Brace Company and Boston Children's Hospital to say like, well, at a seventh grade after school level, could she, cause a lot of times they want you to take your brace off for sports. But at the seventh grade after school level, could she safely play in the brace? And they eventually agreed that yes, she could.
But she really had to learn. I mean, like, yeah. For me also, the scene where she's trying to learn, what was it, to kick with
yeah.
her left leg?
Yeah.
With her dominant leg?
Yes, with her right leg, yeah.
Her right leg? That was really, I felt her pain.
Yeah. Because the way the brace is, you don't have a lot of flexibility on the right side of your body, and she's a lefty. So she kicks with her left leg, and she needs to learn. Sorry. Yes, she needs to learn how to kick with her right leg because you don't have a lot of flexibility on your left hand side because of the way the brace is shaped. So she has to learn how to kick with her non dominant leg, and in the end, that makes her a better soccer player overall because she's now a 2-footed player. Like that's what she comes to realize. But it's really hard to learn how to do that.
It seems also that this was really up the stakes in terms of her being, she really physically couldn't hide because
yes.
Then there's all these interactions with the girls who are on the team around, you know, her looking weird.
Yeah, and not being as good anymore
mm-hmm.
and like sort of slowing the team. There's sort of a sense that she was good and now she's slowing the team down. And she has to come to terms with that. And I think I definitely felt that through my experience with ballet. I didn't feel that as much in soccer because I wasn't a super strong player to begin with. But I sort of translated some of those feelings into something that I thought I wanted it to be a team because I wanted there to be like conflict among the
yeah.
players and the team. I thought it would be more interesting that
way.
And
there was.
Yeah.
So this had me thinking, of course, I had my educator hat on when I was reading this book. I was enjoying it very much, but also thinking in terms of, okay, so if kids were reading this, say, like, in a youth group, in a reading circle, or in a school, or Jewish settings as well, of course, what might be some of the issues that would percolate? So I was curious to hear from your ends. I know you didn't write this as an educational tool, but what do you imagine being some of the ways this could spark conversation in an educational setting? And if you can think in a Jewish, I certainly can say some things too, but I'm curious from your end.
What do you have to say too. I mean, I think this is really about what it feels like to be different. And how we all sort of have moments where we feel different, or situations where we feel like we're sort of an outsider and we can't do what everybody else is doing in the same way they're doing it. And I think it's a good opportunity to talk about what that feels like, how you can help yourself in that moment, and also what might be going on with the people around you that you don't even really know that's going on. So like take time to think. Like somebody else might be nervous going into this activity, or somebody else might be going through something that's causing them to feel a certain way, and just heighten sensitivity. Because I actually met with a couple of Hebrew school classes over the last couple of weeks, and it was really interesting to hear all the different students and you know things that I wouldn't have noticed about them. And one of the students who spoke said she had an eye disorder where she sees things double. And she said, people don't always realize, like, I have a really hard time when I have to read out loud, or when the print is really small. And I had asked, you know, does anybody want to read out loud? And she said, I wish I could have read out loud, but the print was so too small for me. And now, as somebody who's going to be teaching kids every once in a while, I'm going to print it out bigger, because you never know when somebody else is going to be in that position. I would have loved for her to read out loud. So even for me, it's been an opportunity. The book has been an opportunity to think a little bit more critically about how I'm approaching other people. And I feel like there's always, as a kid, as an adult, there's always an opportunity to look around or take a deep breath and stop and say, okay, what are other people going through? Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time thinking about what we're going through. So that's the number one thing. And then I also think that, for me, this book is really like being heard. It's a chance to, I write because I want to be heard. I felt like I spent a lot of time as a kid saying to my parents, like, listen to me, and feeling like nobody was listening to me. And I think we sort of have a tendency to not take what kids are saying seriously. And to say, like, oh, I know that sounds like a big deal, but it's not really a big deal. And, like, next year you'll have different friends anyway, so this won't matter. But it's a big deal when it's happening.
And or to want to solve it.
Exactly.
Right,
yes,
away,
yes.
For them,
yes.
As opposed to having them think through what could be a good solution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. In this moment that they're in, where this moment is real.
Mm-hmm.
And this moment is not next year. And next year feels like a lifetime away. So I also felt like it was a chance to sort of talk about friends listening to each other and parents listening to each other and sort of opening up conversation. I feel like there's not a lot of conversation that happens, at least in my life. I don't see that happening all over the place, and it's good to open up conversation and talk about things and problems we're having. So this, I think, is a teaching tool for that.
It also strikes me there's really interesting interactions with the soccer coach and Rachel assuming that the soccer coach understands why she's missing practice.
Yeah.
And having to, as an educator, think about, and, you know, of course we have had much more heightened sensitivity since I was a kid about diversity and
yeah.
wide range of learners. But I think also when we have rules, we think, like, if a kid's not conforming to the rules, that they're acting out, you know, oh, they're skipping practice because they're lazy, right? And
yep.
they have a real reason. And then on the flip side, her learning how to self-advocate, which, you know, you've already started to speak to this, but for families, I know you don't want to give away all the plot of the book, but what are some of the things, I mean, I was really struck by that with her mom and her dad, she needed to learn communication, and that was quite prominent. What do you think this opens up?
Well, I mean, I think that you're really lucky if you have a parent who listens to you, right? If you have one parent who really listens to you and really hears you, you're really lucky. And I think most kids are not in that position. For a million reasons, because parents are busy, because parents want to solve problems, because I'm not a parent. I feel like I should say that. So I'm only seeing it from the perspective of a child.
It's all good.
But, yeah. But
you have an awareness.
Yeah, but parents want to solve, I mean, as in my experience, my parents are always wanting to solve the problem, like fix the problem. They don't want me to be in pain. And that is a completely reasonable thing. It's also, I think it's important to acknowledge that pain happens at every age, and that the last thing that my parents would want, the last thing that most parents want, is for their child to be in pain. And so sort of solving the problem feels like the best way to not have the pain exist. But I think for me, it was really important to say, like, it's okay to be in pain. Like, it's okay to be a kid and have a thing happen and have it be really hard and have the people around us acknowledge that this is a really hard thing. And sometimes that just feels good to be like, you're like really tough and you're going through this thing that is really hard and that makes you really strong.
I mean, without, if you don't want to get too personal, but this is personal, yeah, you know, you've written to your mom. In the book, it comes to be that we understand that the mom's experience of having scoliosis, she's really kind of projecting that on, not kind of, she is projecting that onto her daughter, and that's making it challenging for them to even be at these doctor's appointments together, because her mom is reliving it the way she lived it and trying to shield her daughter. So did that come from your experience? Were you trying to rewrite things or tell it in a
I think I did
way?
A mix of both. I mean, I definitely, I feel like I use, I feel like as, what I've noticed is that a lot of times I meet parents, and I'll talk about my own experience too, but I meet parents who are seeing something happening in their child that is the same thing that has happened to them. And it's like the last thing you want is for your kid to go through what you went through. It's like a nightmare because you already went through it and it was awful and you know how bad it was and you want to protect your child. And I feel like that's exactly what happened to my mom. She was like, oh my gosh, this is the worst thing ever. I mean, it's like all of the things that were happening to her, happened to her, were sort of coming up again out of nowhere in me. And she wanted it to be okay. She wanted to sort of solve it and bury it until we could move on.
And yet at the same time, one of the big things in the book is like, they said 20 hours a day. You may not do a moment less than that because otherwise you're going to have the same surgery I did.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was this real, like, it is weird. Surgery is not happening. That's how it was in my house. Like, we need to do everything possible to make sure that surgery doesn't happen. Because for my mom, surgery was so traumatic. And I think that's pretty common. I think there's, like, this real sense in families who are dealing with bracing that it's really important, that there's a sense of urgency around wearing the brace, because it is a way, in many, many cases, and in not in all cases, certainly people wear braces and they don't work. It's a very small percentage. But if you wear your brace for 23 hours a day while you're growing, it should work, and it should keep your scoliosis in place. And I should say that it doesn't fix your scoliosis. So I still have scoliosis, but it makes it so that the curve in your spine doesn't move. It doesn't get worse. And so after you're done growing, it won't continue to move. That's really the issue, is that once you are sort of done with puberty and done growing completely, if you've kept your scoliosis below with like about a 35 degree curve, then it won't continue to move. But if you haven't been able to do that, then it will keep moving and cause internal failure in heart and lungs and among other, mostly it's honestly a cosmetic thing, because you start to really not be able to stand up straight. And even after you're done growing, the surgery cannot work. That's a bigger issue, is that you can have a spinal fusion and your spine can continue to move because you didn't catch it at that certain point in time. I think for my mom, she was like, it was literally her worst nightmare, like coming true. Mm-hmm. And of course, as a kid, I didn't think about that. But now as an adult, I can see that that must have been really hard for her. But I also see that she didn't see how, she was just like, you're so lucky. You're like, this thing is easy. But it wasn't easy for me.
Yeah. Really appreciate that you play out those dynamics.
Thank you.
So if people have questions for Ali, feel free to, I don't know what our time frame is, but I figure we'd open
it up. We usually do these for an hour, so we got plenty of time, but it's up to us.
Great. Okay. So, feel free.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
So you jokingly said that you can write at this level, this age, because you are this age, like you feel inside like
yes.
this age or something like that.
Yeah.
But what always amazes me when I read books like this is how people can go back to that period, which was so painful in so many ways. Like some of the scenes you have of Rachel being made fun of or embarrassed and that kind of mortification that you can feel. To me, I'm like, how could you possibly put yourself back? So I really want to understand, how do you get back And I know you feel like you just are, but seriously, how do you get back to that period? And she sounds so much like she's sitting in the doctor's office and the doctors are talking about her body and it's like so embarrassing. And there's just a level of embarrassment and self-consciousness that I never want to think about again. I'm always impressed that people can.
So you owe her an apology.
No, I mean, I'm amazed that like other people, but how do you do that? What's the process? Does it just really just come out like that?
I think I really genuinely feel that embarrassed a lot of the time as an adult. Like I really genuinely do. I mean, I feel like I try really hard as a grown up to not put myself in a situation where I'm going to be around people who are going to embarrass me. But you know, 20% of the time of my life, I'm forced into a situation where I'm with people who I don't really like or who aren't really nice, or I hear them talking about me, or I hear them or worse, I hear them talking about somebody else. And I that almost feels worse because you know that if they're talking about somebody else, they're probably talking about you too. And so I don't think, it doesn't feel so far away for me. I feel like the reason I say that I am still a seventh grader is because I think I treat the world like I'm a seventh grader. And I like look around at every situation as if it's as vulnerable and important as the first time you went through it. So when somebody embarrasses me or when somebody talks about me behind my back, it feels to me like the first time. And I think I'm a sensitive person and I think I wear my feelings on my sleeve and I think that that's part of sort of my genetic makeup. I think because I had this sort of trauma at this age that I can't help but react to it as if I'm still back in that moment. Because I think part of me hasn't evolved past that. Of course, part of me has. But I feel that I'm constantly put in situations where I am reliving it, whether I want to be or not. And I can remove myself from that situation as an adult. I can say like, okay, we're going to leave now. Or, you know, I don't have to be around those people. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen from time to time, or I'm not forced into that situation.
I want to say that I think we all do that to some extent.
Yeah.
And I want to add on a layer to that of, you know, I grew up as a kid without, you know, I'm a dinosaur. So not only did I not have social media, but I didn't have texting, right? So we passed notes old school, and that was pretty harsh, but I didn't have all this. And I appreciated in the book you had some actually really beautiful things that unfold via texting, but also some really challenging stuff. So relating to that question, how, like, what informed your being able to really capture that so solidly? What unfolds in like a split, you know, a 1 minute back and forth in texting?
So I spent a lot of time. I'm lucky enough to have some connections to religious school. I taught at Central Synagogue for 2 years before I started, right after I graduated from college. And a person who was in charge of the program is now the head of Temple Emmanuel here in New York, and he has let me sit in on some religious school classes of sixth and seventh graders and record them so that I can sort of see how mean they are to each other and listen to their banter and sort of remember what it's like. And now, since I'm on Instagram a lot, and I have these lots of girls getting in touch with me, it's kind of amazing to see that I really did get it right. It feels like validation. Everybody will be at a sleepover and I'll get 3 different Instagram messages from the 3 different girls at the sleepover right in a row. And their Instagram profiles are like my besties, blank, 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 and blank. And then I'll check back because I'm just sort of curious to see like if the next week their besties on their Instagram profile have changed. And of course they always have, right? Because this is like the worst possible. I mean, I remember a different version of this. We had it like in our yearbook, or we had it in like it looked different, or we'd have it on our AIM away message.
Like, it was always there. Yeah. Maybe you didn't get it as instantly. So
exactly.
The instantaneous, there's something going on that I wasn't invited to.
So I'm like a first generation AIM. So I did grow up. I was in seventh grade when AIM came out. So I was of the like, oh, am I talking to Matt Damon on AIM generation? Which, of course, you weren't talking to Matt Damon. You're really talking to, like, a mean boy from your class who's like, hi, I'm Matt Damon, you know? So I do feel like I grew up with it a little. At that age, I did have the instantaneousness, But it looked different. It was a different form. But deciding what platform to make it in is complicated, because you've got to think, okay, in 10 years when someone's reading this book, is this still going to, how am I going to make this so that it's still relevant? Which is why I picked text message and not a social media platform, because you don't know how these things are going to evolve and what it's going to look like.
But it seems that the message, no matter, I mean, I just referred to, we pass notes old school across the room, and it's the same, it's a different medium, but
yeah,
it's the same thing of seeing, I had to be the person who passed the note back and forth, but I didn't get the note, and that was very upsetting, right?
Totally.
So, no, but you know, yes. But it's the same, I'm saying it's the same idea as seeing an Instagram of a party and not being invited.
Totally.
Yes. Somebody have a pen, I'll write a report.
or having somebody change their Instagram, like you're not at the sleepover and you're not the bestie anymore.
Right.
So, mean.
And then what I appreciated so much is the way that there were some really positive conversations that were able to take place via texting, some apologies,
yeah,
and some expression of feelings, that in some ways, you know, we can blast it all we want to, but really powerful stuff can happen in a way when you don't have to sit face to face.
Yeah. That is actually really the best part, like especially with the relationship with the boy. His name is Tate. There are things you can say to a boy over text message that you can't say on the phone or you can't say in person. And that made it a little bit more convenient. It was a little bit more convenient for me, mm-hmm, as an author to make it real. Real.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Go ahead. I'm just going to go on with this, with who is your audience.
Yeah.
So is it young girls who want to read about relationships, or is it more young people who have some sort of physical disability or have some challenges? So who were you thinking about when you were writing the book?
So I wrote this book without thinking about anybody else. But my hope was that it would reach people who are going through this experience, people who know people who are going through this experience, mm-hmm, and that it's 10% of the population who has scoliosis. Mm-hmm. So if 10% of adolescents have scoliosis, that means that every single child knows somebody who has scoliosis. And if you don't know somebody, that's because you're not asking. So I wanted to inform everybody.
So it was really to that,
for everybody.
That population.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about girls' relationships.
No, it's really, I mean, it's
that
really...
about, yeah.
Yeah, it's really for like 8 to 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And I think their parents. I mean, mm-hmm, I think this is really a way to look into what's really happening in a seventh grader's life. And I tried to make it as real and honest and horrible and wonderful as possible so that it could be a way to open up conversation.
Well, I think the excerpt you read out loud is a great example of, it can be very easy to dismiss the reality of how serious it is to pick out that first day of school.
Oh my
outfit,
gosh.
Right? And when you know that you're going to be, she can't wear any of her clothes anymore that she had because they literally don't fit around her brace. So this is really serious. And I can imagine if I were a parent of a kid that age, reading that could give me some deeper sensitivity.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So my question was kind of along those lines. What has been the most significant kind of reach out from a person who's read it? And so that's part one. And part two is, have any teenage boys reached out?
So I get about 5 to 10 emails a day. Emails, Instagram messages, Facebook messages from parents, kids, friends of kids who are going through this.
We got one today from someone who just saw the thing and couldn't come today and wrote to both of us and said, mm-hmm, I explained.
Yeah, and it is always literally a pouring. It always feels like to me the first time they've ever told anybody what they're feeling, and it especially the ones that come from a parent whose child just got a brace, and they're like, I get emails that say like, my child is locked in her room right now and I don't know what to do. Can you give me some advice on what to do? You know, this is especially before my book came out. It was a lot of like, please, can this book come out any sooner? Can you ask Scholastic to get this book out sooner? Because I literally don't know how I'm going to ever get her out of her room. So I feel like, and I always write back because to me, like that is the reason. I was the child locked in my room. My mom was the parent who like didn't have anybody to talk to about it, or wasn't a stranger feels so much safer. They think they're never going to hear back from me. And so I always try to write back. And I've actually gotten some advice from some psychologists on how to write back in a way that is like responsible and also like honest with what I want to say, which is like, I'm so glad that they told somebody. And I'm so glad that person was me. But every single time it's like tears. I'm like a disaster because it's like literally every time it's exactly why I wrote this book. It's why this book needed to be in the world so badly. So there hasn't been another book about scoliosis since 1974. So Deanie was the last book.
That was the first thing I asked Allie when she told me about this book. I'm like, is that like Deanie?
Yeah, and that's how we pitched it, as a modern Deanie. Because when I was had a brace, Deanie was, I loved Deanie, but I, for two reasons, I felt like I couldn't relate to Deanie. One, her brace was so different than mine, which probably wasn't a great reason. But also, she was so beautiful. She was a model, and I didn't feel like a model, and I didn't know anybody who felt like a model. So I just, it was harder for me to really turn, and I liked the book still. I loved everything Judy Blume, but I wanted something that felt like all kinds of kids could relate to the book. Oh, and you asked about boys. So I taught at Washington Hebrew a week or so ago, and I had two boys come up to me after that who wanted the book, who wanted it signed, and shared some of their own experiences with me, and they felt like it was really similar. And they were actually, one of them was a teenage boy, which was sort of surprising, you know, I mean, a ninth grader.
Which so. I think also speaks to, again, from the education vantage point, if educators can think of, you know, it would be an easy thing to just assign this for like a girls Rosh Chodesh group or something, but like to assign it to a Hebrew school class and then being able to get people to talk about it from their multiple viewpoints.
Yeah, definitely. Jill?
I also got my MFA at the new school, but...
Oh, great. That's awesome. Did you do the regular program?
Writing for Children.
Oh, you did. Oh, so nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
That's so great. So David is my editor now.
I figured as much.
Okay.
I haven't read it. I can't wait to read it. But
thank you.
I have a question for you, though. It may not be answerable, so forgive me in advance, but when you write from something so autobiographical, was it hard to sort of fictionalize it? You know what I mean? Like, remember that it doesn't have to be exactly what your experience was.
So that's a really good question. It probably wasn't hard in this case for me because I wrote all of my feelings in the first draft that I felt like I needed to write. And then I had to throw a lot of it away because there was no plot. And what I realized by realizing that there was no plot was I realized that my experience was not interesting. And I thought that's why I thought your quote was so great about like about fiction being has to be it can sometimes be truer than real life. Mm-hmm. Like nothing that happens in this book happened to me, because fiction made it so much easier to talk about what I felt like was happening to me. So like every scene with friends, like the things that happened to me felt like that, but they didn't look like that. And so it was all fiction almost felt freeing. Because I got to say, like, oh, this horrible moment happened, and this is what I thought it looked like. And I got to make it bigger than it really was, but that's really what it felt like. So it was sort of fun to get to play with it in that way. So it took me a while to get there, though. Like, at first, I definitely was like, but that happened in real life. And what do you mean it doesn't feel true? That happened. But eventually, I was able to sort of say, like, oh, yeah, this isn't interesting at all. And I need to have something that is interesting and that's going to work. Because I got to the point where I was like, how can there be no books about scoliosis? This is, like, so important to so many people.
So
thank you.
Yeah. I have sort of related question. I'm thinking about your parents are probably similar age to them and what it felt like for them. And I wondered if how much you spoke to them and used what you spoke to them about now when you portrayed the parents, you know, and sort of how they felt about you writing the book.
So I definitely talked to my mom a lot about, we had never really talked about it. Like after my brace came off, we just never talked about it. But what's strange for a lot of reasons is that it was always there and it made our relationship very complicated for a lot of reasons. I don't know if you said you haven't
read it. No, I'm gonna
read it. Okay. So you haven't read the book yet. So it does get, there is resolution in the book that didn't exist in reality. So it made our relationship very complicated, sort of, but it was all under the rug, under the surface. And I think when I graduated from college, I I was really trying to figure out why I was so unhappy. And I was really digging deep to find myself and to find why this, what hurt so much. And it took me a long time to realize that I just never dealt with this. And in dealing with it, I had to talk to my mom about it because she was sort of the root of a lot of this and a lot of tension that had gone on in my house. I think for my siblings too. I mean, they weren't part of this experience. But whenever something's happening to one sibling, it's sort of everybody hears the fighting. Everybody sort of feels that. So we spent a lot of time talking about it, like in the years after I graduated from college. But when I decided to write this book, I sort of stopped talking to both of them about it, except when I had medical questions or needed connections. And I called my dad and I said, "Do you know a doctor who does this? Can you help me?" I think they were very scared to read the book for a lot of reasons. But I gave them early copies, and they both love it. And they're very excited.
As they should.
they said, "This isn't us," and this is nice. but I felt a lot better once I had them on board. It probably didn't hurt that I dedicated the book to them.
We can laugh about it, but truly, I think, as we mentioned earlier, one of the really important things in this book is that there is, in the family dynamic, a commitment ultimately to finding something that works for the different people in the family,
yeah,
which we know is not always the case,
yes,
and didn't come easily to these parents, but they were committing to it.
Yeah. No, and I think that I can say as I'm sitting here now, many, many years beyond when I first started having the conversations with my mom as an adult, that we have all sort of committed to sort of a healthy conversation around this. And this book has sort of been, I think, healing for my family in a lot of ways. Healing for my dad, who was like the fix-it, and my mom, who had all the trauma, and me, who didn't get anybody saying, like, "This was hard for you." And I think we've all sort of come full circle, which feels really nice and feels like it legitimizes that sort of commitment.
And I would just say, landing, ending. I mean, maybe with one more question in there, but like, I know we're wrapping up on a positive note. It seems to me, both as an educator and as a parent and a person in this world, thinking that the most important thing is really just making the space for that listening to happen, because it is hard. It's hard whether we are full-time working or whatnot. There's just so much going on, and in this book, and it seems in your life too, that there was a baby coming, right? There's just so much happening. How do we, if we make space and allow for that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also like a good question is like, how do you do that? How do you do that in a family? I think legitimacy too. I think there's this sort of sense, and I said this earlier, but I think there's this sense that what you're going through as a kid just sort of doesn't matter as much. Or it's like, it'll be okay. There's just sort of, I heard a lot, it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. It's going to work out. And that doesn't really help. It in that moment where you're feeling the whatever the pain is for the very first time, whether it's with a boy or a friend or something that happens in school, a grade, or something you can't do that everybody else seems to be able to do, that, you know, and that could be in gym, that could be in school, that could be in any part of your very big life. I think parents often are like, this is a small life and a little life and a young life, and like, it will be okay. It will be okay. To the parent, it will be okay. But to the person going through it, it doesn't feel like it's ever going to be okay. And we sort of build up resistance as adults to say, like, we learn through experience that things do get better, and that the first time when you stumble, you will get up and it will get better. But you don't know that when you're doing it for the first time. And I think creating the space for that to be okay is really important.
Elise, you've been writing.
Oh, I had a question. Obviously, I love this book for many, many different reasons. And I was really excited to hear about the series of books that are now going to be launched. And I'm just wondering what you learned from this experience that will be evident or that, you know, will help the process for your next book.
Thank you. That's a great question. So I handed in my next book, which is called Focused, and is about a seventh grade girl who's an amazing chess player who has undiagnosed attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
When's that coming out?
That's coming out summer 2018.
I think you're going to get a lot of emails.
So there are no books about girls with ADHD. And actually there is one, and I shouldn't say there are none. There is one, and it's very good. But my book's going to be great. So that I handed in, but I haven't started editing it. I haven't gotten any feedback on it, so we'll see how that goes. But what I have learned is that you have to have plot. And what I've learned is that it just takes time. It takes time to write a good book, and it takes a lot of editing, and that it's okay if it's not perfect when you first hand it in. I think most of writing is in revision. That's the thing that I didn't realize is that when you hand, I wanted to like hand my book into my editor and have her be like, "You're the best! Like you did the A plus, great job."
Then she wouldn't have a job.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's true. And also like, and then her job would be meaningless.
Right.
And I think partly editors want to have a hand in they want to have put their own stamp on a book. And my editor, who is Cheryl Klein, left, and she's now with a different publishing house, and so I have a new editor. So that's a new challenge, and I face all these different sort of things. It feels like having a new teacher at the beginning of the year, because I don't know what it's going to be. I, like, know him, and he seems nice, but I don't know what it's going to be like. Is he going to like
me? And I actually went to college with him.
Yes.
He's great.
Yeah, and they were very good friends. So you just don't know how it's going to go. But I think, I have Cheryl's voice in the back of my head sort of telling me things as I'm writing, like, oh, no, don't do that. So I have her there, and I have her email, so I can email her if I have a problem. But now I'll have a new teacher in a lot of ways and a new person to learn from. So I'm excited about that.
Good hands.
Yeah. I feel like I learned a lot from writing this book. I learned how to write a book. So I'm going to write a second one. And then my third one comes out in summer 2019. And I don't know what it's about yet. So if you have any ideas, let me know.
Okay.
A Jewish seminary.
Yeah, no, that won't go anywhere.
But it'll be fiction.
It still won't go anywhere. Okay. So thank you both for wonderful
food. Thank you.
And we will gather here with better immediate climate conditions in the summer of 2018, was it?
Yes, okay.
So we'll see you then, and if you want to come to any book talks between now and then, you're invited to those as well.
And I can sign books, and there are bookmarks here if you want to take a bookmark. They're really pretty.
Thank you so much.
So fun.
This is so fun.
Good. I'm glad it was fun for me too. Yeah,
good.
Have.
Thank you. You want to come down to our office?
No, I gotta
go.
Run,
okay.
But we'll just set a meeting with you.